advantages of short stature. She is thrilled that she had it. One LPA executive has said, "We need to wait to an age where you can have a real discussion with the individual who's going to have it done, and have it really, truly be their decision. We'd recommend that they meet with a psychologist, that there be a very open and extended dialogue about it before a decision is reached." But like the arguments for delaying cochlear implants, this one is deeply flawed. This process works only during the time of natural growth, late childhood, and early adolescence. It's later than the period of language acquisition, but much earlier than full maturity. Some doctors have claimed that limb lengthening may help to prevent the spinal and other orthopedic problems associated with dwarfism, and this is a topic of urgent debate. Dan Kennedy, who has not pursued ELL for his daughter, candidly writes, "A dwarf gains considerable benefit from limb lengthening simply because his upper arms are made longer. What is the most important thing you can think of other than being able to wipe yourself?" Every case of ELL is different, so the risks and rewards cannot be generalized. And because ELL is fairly new, the long-term outcome is unclear. The rate of complications, ranging from mild and transient to severe and permanent, is higher for ELL than for any other orthopedic surgery. The target population for the procedure faces many orthopedic problems, even without surgery, which further muddies the swampy waters. Some children seem to move easily toward a celebration of their difference. For others, difference is almost insufferable. Likewise, some parents can tolerate having a child who is different, and some can't. At 9, I'd have given anything not to be gay, and would have gone through a procedure like this had there been one for my condition. Now that I'm 48, I'm glad that I didn't compromise my body. The trick is knowing which prejudices of a 9-year-old are 9-year-old prejudices that will change with time, and which ones are true readings of the heart that will last into adulthood. The attitude of parents frequently shapes the mindset of children, and surgeons must try to penetrate that film so they can clearly see the interests of the person on whom such a procedure would be performed. "My daughter hated being a dwarf," one mother said to me. "She would point to the dwarfs we introduced into the house, lovely people, and say, 'I'd rather be dead than be like those people. Those people are freaks. I hate them.'" She didn't want to be a part of their world. We tried so hard to make it nice for her. The daughter insisted on and is glad to have had the procedure. Writing about elective surgery on children, medical ethicist Arthur Frank observes in the Hastings Center report, "The possibility of fixing renders inescapable the question of whether or not to fix." Surgery originated as a process of excision. The augmentative model of surgery is a modern intervention. Though descriptions of orthopedic procedures date back to ancient Greece, the use of such procedures in a recognizable way came from the 18th century French physician Nicolas André. Michel Foucault famously used an image from André's Orthopedia, or The Art of Correcting and Preventing Deformities in Children, 1743, to open his own Discipline and Punish, where it was intended as a model of persecution. The image shows, simply, a bent tree tied to a straight stake. Foucault would have regarded ELL as a form of torture brought about by a society that insists on conformity. Yet while it may be a high calling to make the world more welcoming of dwarfs, it is easier in any given case to make dwarfs fit the world. The question is whether dwarfs who accommodate the world facilitate the continuance of social injustice, whether there is a moral imperative for them to refuse such procedures to keep the pressure on for the world to accommodate other dwarfs. This may be a great deal to demand of an LP who is trying to live a life of some personal satisfaction. While human growth hormone, HGH, does not confer greater height on people with skeletal dysplasias, its use has long been approved for people with pituitary dwarfism. In recent years, HGH has increasingly been used aesthetically for young people in the general population who are not tall and wish to be so, or whose parents seek to protect them from the social disadvantages of shortness. Like ELL, such hormone therapy must be undertaken during the growth years, usually in the early teens. Whether it is effective in people with adequately functioning pituitary systems is debatable, but some studies indicate that it can add up to 4 inches of additional height. The FDA recently approved Humatrope for unexplained shortness, that is, for men with a final height under 5'3" and for women with a final height of under 4'11". Of course, it is impossible to know what someone's final height will be until he reaches it, at which point it's too late for Humatrope. So this whole process is based on statistics and guesswork. The cost of treating people with Humatrope through these critical growth years is between $12,000 and $40,000. Some wealthy parents have sought HGH for children of average height because they believe that making their children really tall is a favor to them. The advantages of height have been broadly established. Tall people garner more votes in elections, and recent studies show that men over 6 feet tall earn on average a salary 12% higher than shorter men. Tall people are icons of beauty in films, in advertisements, and on fashion runways. Proportionality has been praised as the essence of beauty since ancient times. Vitruvius, writing in the time of Christ, said that the Greek sculptors had understood this perfectly and had expressed a universal ideal. For the human body is so designed by nature that the face, from the chin to the top of the forehead and the lowest roots of the hair, is a tenth part of the whole height, he begins, proposing a very undwarf-like body type. Our language is full of praising expressions such as stand tall and proud, and of disparaging terms such as fall short of, comes up short, paltry, and puny. The use of dwarf as a verb, a disparaging one in most instances, does not help matters. William Safire once wrote in the New York Times of how Pluto had been reclassified as a new category called dwarf planet, and all textbooks in all languages are ordered to refer to it with that adjectival derogation. The journalist John Richardson, who has investigated the lives of LPs, wrote, "Dwarfs will never assimilate. As long as movie stars have full lips and oval faces, as long as women dream of tall, dark, and handsome, dwarfs are the difference that stays different." Kiki Peck was born with Nyst dysplasia, a random mutation that leads to a rare variant of dwarfism characterized by lack of type 2 collagen, which occurs in cartilage and in the clear gel that fills the eyeball. It results not only in diminutive stature, but also in enlarged joints, a flat nose, severe myopia, hearing loss, and distortions of all other areas of the body where cartilage plays an important role. Kiki has Swiss cheese cartilage, which results in arthritis-like symptoms and joint stiffness, a barrel-shaped trunk, large hands, and wide feet, hips described by one of her doctors as like melting ice, and bones that are unnaturally thin, with ends that are unnaturally wide. Her illness was not observed at birth, but when her mother, Chrissy Trapani, brought her to the doctor for her 1 month visit, she had lost weight. The doctor told Chrissy to stop breastfeeding and use bottles so she could keep a rigorous account of Kiki's feeding habits. The weeks that followed were frightening. Kiki was diagnosed with failure to thrive, and her life hung in the balance. She was taken to the University of Michigan Hospital, within driving distance of the Pecks' house, and even though none of her doctors had ever seen a case of NEIST, at the time there were only 200 known cases worldwide, they arrived at a correct diagnosis from X-ray images of her unusually shaped bones. The months that followed were occupied with visits to geneticists and other specialists. "I just wanted to talk to somebody who knew what it would be like for her," Chrissy said. "There was nobody." Kiki was found to be severely myopic and was fitted for spectacles at 2 months. "I went to 4 different places to find glasses that would fit her tiny face," Chrissy recalled. The woman was adjusting the glasses, and Kiki was screaming, screaming, screaming. All of a sudden she stopped and just stared. You could tell from the look on her face that she was like, "I can see." Because cartilage is a part of the inner structure of the ear, Kiki also had significant hearing deficits, and she was fitted for hearing aids at 6 months. "That was a whole other adventure," Chrissy said. "Try keeping hearing aids on a 6-month-old. We lost a lot, and they're not cheap things to lose." By that time, however, Kiki had started to grow, and while she didn't grow as much as an unaffected child, she was keeping pace for her condition. Chrissy's parents had been upset by the diagnosis. "When I told my dad, my mom said he went right out to the golfing range and just slammed a whole basket full of balls. Then he came inside and started researching, and he found a NEIST group in Minnesota. The whole family flew out to meet them. I remember preparing myself for the shock of meeting an adult who was affected," Chrissy said. "Then I met her. She was a great person, super friendly, and super accommodating, with all kinds of answers. So it was really good for me and my parents." Building a life was extremely challenging, and Chrissy found an outlet in poetry. The form entails control and was a good one to pursue in a powerless situation. "We didn't know if Kiki would survive," Chrissy said. "We didn't know what kind of surgery she might need. We didn't know what would happen to her spine. Discs are cartilage. She didn't begin to walk until she was 2, and even when she was just learning to stand up, she'd look arthritic, like she's 80. Chrissy said people with NEIST are also sure of themselves and strong-willed. And quite intelligent, she added, perhaps because they have had to do problem-solving since day 1. Even in preschool, Kiki's teacher said that she always knows what she wants, and she's always had a great self-image. "When I met Kiki, she was in 5th grade, almost 11. She had crutches next to her in the living room where we sat to talk, and had recently been fitted with a brace to keep her back straight. Chrissy and I were in jeans, but Kiki was wearing a party dress and big boots for our meeting. Something in her was incorrigibly festive. When I wake up, I'm stiff," she said. "I can't make a fist, and when I go to school, my fingers aren't ready to write yet. She uses a tricycle to get around the building. She announced to me that she was planning to be a veterinarian and a rock star when she grew up." Chrissy said, "I'm sure she will one day, if that's what she really wants to do." Kiki had asked for a pet chihuahua because she thought they could be little together. Money being tight, she got a hamster. While I was at the house, Kiki and her older brother, Josh, had an argument because Kiki had kicked something and it had hit Josh. "I needed to move it," she said. "Why couldn't you just lean over and do it?" he asked. Kiki said, "I don't want to, because then it would be hard to get up." Josh was righteously indignant, but Kiki had a faraway look I have come to recognize in disabled children who don't know to what extent they are exploiting their difference for their own benefit. "Sometimes my brother thinks I have too much attention, and I try to tell him that it's not my fault," she said. "Yeah, it is," Josh said. "Sometimes We actually say we hate each other, Kiki said to me pointedly. She paused and crossed her arms, then said very definitively, and the truth is that we really love each other. Chrissy divorced Kiki's father, Caleb, when Kiki was in second grade. Her father thought that she needed less medical care than I thought she needed, Chrissy said. When she had her surgeries, Caleb didn't come to the hospital. I think he was scared. For the last 10 years, I've been just barely above water, gasping for air. All my vacation time was spent at the University of Michigan Hospital. Chrissy described the relentless rounds, the orthopedist 4 to 6 times a year, the ophthalmologist 1 or 2 times a year, the audiologist and otolaryngologist each 2 times a year at least, the rheumatologist regularly. Kiki has constant physical therapy, and Chrissy does stretching exercises with her daily. So many decisions, Chrissy said. She's in pain, and replacing her hips might help. But if we replace them too soon, that could disrupt other growth. So when do we want to do it? Because it's so rare, there isn't much information, and that's the worst part, really. Chrissy sighed. I used to run marathons, and someone told me once that if you smile the whole way, you won't feel the pain. It worked. So that's what I do with this, too. Mothering Kiki has been nearly revelatory for Chrissy. I grew up painfully shy. I was a teenager who worried about whether I was a few pounds overweight or if my hair and makeup were right. Then when she came into my life, it was just like, how can I say I have to be a certain way when I know she'll never be that certain way? Why was I ever obsessed about that? Even when we've had our tantrums and I'm at the edge, I realize her strength. I was always really shy and self-conscious about the way I looked, or I didn't feel so good about myself. Here I have this child who is the epitome of self-esteem under the most extreme circumstances. It's just a source of wonder to me. Chrissy later wrote, I think of the word brave, how I have to say it as a mantra, one syllable, one beat. She is more brave than I. A few years after Chrissy and Caleb divorced, and a few months after Kiki had major leg surgery, Chrissy was diagnosed with breast cancer requiring surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. There was a point where Kiki and I were joking with each other about who goes to see doctors more, Chrissy said. Having had Kiki for so long made the cancer easier, because I'm like, this is just another thing to deal with and overcome. Just keep moving. I didn't hide it from the kids. Josh was more frightened by it. Kiki was just head on, like she's always been. Her response was, my mom is always taking me to the doctor, and now I'm taking my mom. When I went through my lumpectomy, and I was lying on the couch recovering, she put a wet towel on my head and cut up oranges and fed them to me. When Kiki learned that her mother needed to shave her head before starting chemo, she offered to do it for her. When they were finished, Kiki announced that she would shave her own head too. Chrissy tried to stop her, but she was absolutely adamant. My mom got so involved with my surgery, she said. I hope it didn't give her cancer. Since I spent so much time feeling different, I know how hard it is. So I wanted my mother to have someone else and not be different all by herself. Chapter 4. Down Syndrome. Anyone involved in any way with disability has come across Welcome to Holland, a modern fable written by Emily Pearl Kingsley in 1987. In fact, any such person has come across it repeatedly. Several hundred people have forwarded it to me since I started writing this book. Google shows more than 5,000 postings of it, in connection with everything from leukemia to cranial abnormalities. Dear Abby runs it every October. It is standard issue from doctors to parents of disabled newborns. It has been set to music as a folk song and as a cantata. It serves as a theme for conferences and has been published in one of the Chicken Soup for the Soul books. People have even named their disabled children after it, Holland Abigail, for example. It is as iconic to disability as How Do I Love Thee is to romance. Many told me that it gave them the hope and strength to be good parents. Others told me that it was too rosy and set up false expectations, and yet others said that it didn't adequately acknowledge the special joy of special needs children. Here is the piece in its entirety. I am often asked to describe the experience of raising a child with a disability, to try to help people who have not shared that unique experience to understand it, to imagine how it would feel. It's like this. When you're going to have a baby, it's like planning a fabulous vacation trip to Italy. You buy a bunch of guidebooks and make your wonderful plans. The Colosseum, the Michelangelo David, the gondolas in Venice. You may learn some handy phrases in Italian. It's all very exciting. After months of eager anticipation, the day finally arrives. You pack your bags and off you go. Several hours later, the plane lands. The stewardess comes in and says, "Welcome to Holland." "Holland," you say. "What do you mean, Holland? I signed up for Italy. I'm supposed to be in Italy. All my life, I've dreamed of going to Italy." But there's been a change in the flight plan. They've landed in Holland, and there you must stay. The important thing is, they haven't taken you to a horrible, disgusting, filthy place full of pestilence, famine, and disease. It's just a different place. So you must go out and buy new guidebooks, and you must learn a whole new language, and you will meet a whole new group of people you would never have met. It's just a different place. It's slower paced than Italy, less flashy than Italy. But after you've been there for a while and you catch your breath, you look around and you begin to notice that Holland has windmills and Holland has tulips. Holland even has Rembrandts. But everyone you know is busy coming and going from Italy, and they're all bragging about what a wonderful time they had there. And for the rest of your life, you will say, "Yes, that's where I was supposed to go. That's what I had planned." And the pain of that will never, ever, ever, ever go away, because the loss of that dream is a very, very significant loss. But if you spend the rest of your life mourning the fact that you didn't get to Italy, you may never be free to enjoy the very special, the very lovely things about Holland. 7 to 8 million Americans have intellectual disabilities. 1 out of 10 American families is directly affected by mental retardation. Down syndrome, the result of a triplication of the 21st chromosome, is the most common form of intellectual disability, occurring in about 1 of every 800 births in the United States, for a total American population of more than 400,000 people. Far more such pregnancies are created. More than 40% of fetuses with DS miscarry or are stillborn. In addition to mental retardation, Down syndrome may entail heart defects, occurring in about 40% of cases, loose joints, thyroid disorders, a malformed digestive tract, leukemia, early onset Alzheimer's symptoms, in at least 25% of cases, a far higher proportion for those who live past 60, celiac disease, shortness, obesity, hearing and vision problems, infertility, immune deficiencies, epilepsy, a small mouth, and a protruding tongue. Poor muscle tone affects the development of mobility, coordination, and, because of low tone in the mouth, speech. None of these features, except for slowed mental development, occurs in all cases of DS. People with DS also show unusually low rates of most cancers and are not subject to hardening of the arteries. People with DS have smaller brains, with reductions in most areas, and fewer neurons in the cortex. They also have reduced synaptic density and delay of myelination, the developmental process through which nerves are sheathed. They are at increased risk for depression, psychosis, disruptive behavior disorders, anxiety, and autism. Down syndrome appears to have existed in all human populations across the span of human history. It has been found in chimpanzees and gorillas as well. The original and most reliable form of prenatal testing for DS is amniocentesis. The physician uses a needle to withdraw an ounce or so of amniotic fluid in which some fetal cells are adrift. These cells are then analyzed for various conditions. Some people wish to avoid amnio because it carries a risk of miscarriage and because it seems intrusive for the fetus. CVS can be performed earlier than amnio, but carries a greater risk of miscarriage. The triple screen, done in the second trimester, tests the mother's blood for proteins and hormones associated with DS. Introduced in 1988, it identifies about two-thirds to three-quarters of cases. A quadruple screening, which looks for another hormone, brings this success rate up to four-fifths. Ultrasound has been used to look for birth defects since the 1970s, and as imaging technologies and our ability to interpret the scans become more sophisticated, this is an increasingly reliable way to diagnose DS. Early in pregnancy, about the same time as CVS, an ultrasound test, nuchal translucency, measures the fluid behind the fetus's neck, which is increased in DS and other anomalies. Later in pregnancy, 3D ultrasound can provide more precise information. New, non-invasive blood tests may replace these techniques if they prove similarly accurate. One detects placental messenger RNA in the mother's bloodstream, and another measures bloodstream fragments of chromosome 21. No technique can establish the severity of prospective impairments, mental or physical. At the time Emily Pearl Kingsley and her husband, Charles, were expecting, they decided to forego amniocentesis because the risk of injuring the fetus seemed too great. "And if I had had amnio," Emily said, "I would have terminated, and I would have missed out on what has been not only the most difficult, but also the most enriching experience of my life." Jason Kingsley was born in 1974 in Westchester County, north of New York City. The doctor told Charles that such a child belonged in an institution and discouraged the Kingsleys from seeing the baby. He said that this mongoloid would never learn to speak, think, walk, or talk. Emily was kept tranquilized and given pills to stop lactation on the assumption that she would not take the baby home. "They said he'd never be able to distinguish us from other adults," Emily recalled. "He would never be creative. He would never have an imagination. I was collecting a first edition of Lewis Carroll, and putting aside all this Gilbert and Sullivan stuff that I love, I had boxes of things that I was going to do with this kid, all a bit sophisticated and terrific. I turn on the television. All of a sudden, there's nobody who looks like me. Everybody is so perfect. I had vanished. I cried for 5 days nonstop." This was soon after the exposé of horrific conditions at Willowbrook, and Emily and Charles couldn't bear the idea of institutionalization. But it was also a moment in the 1970s when nurture arguments held ascendancy. People sought to bring about their children's remission from various grave conditions through insight and lavish kindness. A social worker at the hospital where Jason was born mentioned that a new, experimental program called Early Intervention might help kids with DS to learn some basic skills. "We had to give it a try," Emily said. "If it turned out to be heartbreaking and miserable, we could institutionalize him based on our own experience, not on hearsay." So Emily and Charles brought Jason home, and when he was 10 days old, they went to the Mental Retardation Institute. I stood in the parking lot with my 10-day-old baby in my arms, and I couldn't make my feet walk through a door that had that name on it, Emily recalled. I was paralyzed. Charles pulled up in his car, saw me there, grabbed me by the elbow, and dragged me into the building. The doctor at the institute said almost the opposite of what they had been told in the birthing room, that they had to start with stimulation of every kind, especially engagement of Jason's senses, because no one knew what might be possible for a child who received enough positive input. Emily and Charles ripped apart the elegant pastel baby's room they had created, painting it blinding red with stenciled green and purple flowers. Emily persuaded the local supermarket to give her the giant lacy snowflakes they had used as Christmas decorations, and those went up too. They hung things from the ceiling on springs, so they were always moving and bobbing. "You could get nauseated just walking in there," Emily said. They put in a radio and a record player, so there was music all the time. They talked to Jason day and night. They moved his limbs through stretches and exercises to improve his muscle tone. For 6 months, Emily would cry herself to sleep. "I almost drowned him in the tears I shed over him," she recalled. "I had this fantasy that I would develop a very fine tweezers and go in and pick out every extra chromosome of every cell in his body." One day, when he was 4 months old, Emily was saying, "See the flower?" for the 800th time. And Jason reached out and pointed to the flower. "He could have been stretching," she said. "But I experienced it as him saying, 'Okay, Mom, I got it.' It was a message to me. I am not a lump of mashed potatoes. I am a person." Emily called Charles immediately. "He's in there," she cheered. The phase that followed was almost ecstatic. Emily and Charles tried to come up with novel experiences for Jason almost daily. Emily sewed a quilt that had a different fabric every few inches, terry cloth, velvet, astroturf, so that every time Jason moved, he would experience a new sensation. When he was 6 months old, they took a giant roasting pan and filled it with Jell-O, 40 packages worth, and lowered him into it so he could writhe around and experience the strange texture, and eat some of it too. They used brushes on the soles of his feet to make his toes curl up. He learned better than Emily and Charles could have hoped. Though his speech had the blurred cadences typical of people with intellectual disability, he was able to communicate with it. Emily taught him the alphabet. He picked up numbers. He learned words in Spanish from watching Sesame Street, where Emily had been a writer since 1970. Jason started reading at 4, ahead of many typical peers, and one day put together alphabet blocks to spell a headline, "Son of Sam." At 6, he had a 4th grade reading level and could do basic math. The Kingsleys started counseling families who had just had babies with Downs. It became a passionate crusade that other people shouldn't be told that their kid had no potential, We would meet them in the first 24 hours and say, "You're going to have to work harder, but don't let anybody tell you that it's impossible." By the time Jason was 7, he could count to 10 in 12 languages. He had learned sign as well as English, and soon could tell Bach from Mozart from Stravinsky. Emily took Jason on the road. They addressed obstetricians, nurses, and psychologists, as well as parents of children with Down syndrome. The year Jason was 7, they gave 104 lectures. Emily felt that she had licked DS. She lived in triumph. Emily arranged for Jason to appear as a regular guest on Sesame Street, and he normalized tolerance for a new generation, playing with other children in a way that acknowledged but did not stigmatize his condition. She wrote a screenplay based on their experience and insisted that the producers cast children with Down syndrome, even though actors with DS had never before been on TV. Jason provided the voice for the character modeled on him. Jane Pauley did a special about Jason and a friend who also had Down syndrome and had received early intervention. The two boys eventually wrote a book, Count Us in which Jason described the obstetrician who told his parents that he would never learn to recognize them or talk. Give a baby with a disability a chance to grow, a full life, to experience a half-full glass instead of a half-empty glass, he wrote. Think of your abilities, not your disability. Jason became the first DS celebrity. His renown marked the emergence of Down syndrome as a horizontal identity. 30 years later, Emily received a special award from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services for her work showing people with disabilities in mainstream media. Emily had been told her child was subhuman. When this proved untrue, it was logical to question every traditional assumption about DS, and Jason broke records and stymied expectations. Yet while he could learn more than anyone else with Down syndrome had ever learned, he had limitations. Nuance eluded him. He could read better than he could understand what he was reading. "I knew I couldn't remove the chromosomes," Emily said, "but I really thought that maybe nobody knew what these kids were capable of. No one had been able to do what he did." Then around the time he turned 8, the rest of the world caught up and went past, and I began to realize all the things he couldn't do and would never be able to do. All the trained SEAL stuff was fantastic, but in the real world, the intelligence to count in many languages is not as important as social intelligence, and he didn't have it. I had not made the Down syndrome go away. Jason would hug strangers and didn't understand that they weren't friends. He wanted to attend sleepaway camp, but after he'd been there a week, Emily got a call saying that the other kids didn't like him and didn't like how he kept hugging everyone. Some parents had said that if Jason didn't leave, they were going to pull their own kids. When he played soccer, he would forget or not understand which team he was on. The typical kids who had been his friends began to snigger. He continued to play with toys for small children, and he watched cartoons beamed at kids half his age. It seemed that the miracle was unraveling. He could be a TV star and a successful author, but he could not function in mundane settings. "It was an unbelievably horrible readjustment for me," Emily said. Jason, too, was in anguish. One night when Emily was tucking him into bed, he said, "I hate this face. Can you find a store where we can get me a new face? A normal face?" Another night he said, "I'm so sick and tired of this Down syndrome business. When is it going to go away?" Emily could only kiss him on the head and tell him to go to sleep. Emily began to rework her lectures. She still wanted to encourage people not to institutionalize their children, She wanted to say that she loved her son, and that he loved her. But she didn't want to sugarcoat her message. It was at this time that she wrote, "Welcome to Holland." Bringing Jason up wasn't the hell she had been told about when he was born, but it was also not Italy. Jason had become famous for breaking the mold, and it was hard to figure out whether to keep dragging him to greater heights or to let him stay where he was comfortable being, whether he'd have a happier life with more achievement, or whether that achievement was only a vanity project. As Jason reached adolescence, his classmates began having parties, but he wasn't invited and spent Saturday nights at home watching TV and moping. Emily called other parents of teenagers with Down syndrome asking, "Is your kid as lonely on Saturday night as mine is?" So when Jason was 14, the Kingsleys began to host a monthly party at their home with food, soda, and dancing. They felt so normal, Emily said. They loved it. The parents would sit upstairs and talk about their shared experiences, so it was really two parties. When I met Emily, the monthly parties had been going for 15 years. She had bought a karaoke machine, and the kids, many no longer really kids, were having a rollicking good time. I always say to people, invest in inclusion, but keep one foot firmly planted in the Down syndrome community, Emily said. This is where your kids' ultimate friendships are going to come from. Jason had been in a special needs classroom, but nonetheless passed the exams requisite for a high school diploma. Emily located a post-high school program in Amenia, New York, where young people with learning disabilities, most without other challenges, were taught money management, time management, cooking, and housekeeping, in addition to clerical and other job-related skills. Jason's credentials and test scores were way ahead of those of most of the other applicants. The parents freaked out when they saw that Jason was applying to this school, Emily said. They thought it was going to turn into a retard school. So I went to the school president. "What's the criterion for entering the school? Is it the shape of your eyes? Is it how cute you are? If so, let's go down the hall, and I'll show you a few kids you ought to expel." Only after Emily threatened a lawsuit was Jason finally admitted. He was later judged by the administration to be a model student. Nonetheless, many things remain elusive. Jason wanted to drive. "It's fun for boys and sexy for girls," he said in Count Us In. "You can get girls if you drive." He had announced that when he was old enough, he wanted a red Saab turbo convertible. Emily paused as she recounted this, deeply frustrated. "So how do you tell your kid that he's never going to drive?" I said, "Your reaction time is slower than other people's. I made it something physical. He's no dope. He shouldn't drive because he doesn't have the judgment. But how to say so?" Jason lives in a lonely demographic. He is too bright for most others with Down syndrome. They can't keep up with his verbal abilities, his puns, his games. But he is not bright enough for people without disabilities. "He has no peers," Emily said, with a mix of enormous pride and terrible regret. Jason described a life for himself that included a family and a dog and a white picket fence. He has a sort of girlfriend who also has DS. Emily took him in for a vasectomy. Though many males with DS are infertile, some are not. "It only takes one sperm to do it," Emily said. "We did not want to leave the responsibility of birth control to a girl whose capacity we were unclear of. If he wants to set up housekeeping with somebody and have a marriage, I'll give him the wedding of the age. Being a good parent, though, I simply don't see how he could do it." Charles's dream was that his son would live independently, so he set Jason up in an apartment of his own. Jason found his first job at Barnes & Noble, tearing the covers off magazines destined for recycling. He found it excruciatingly boring and kept making up ways to amuse himself. When his supervisor insisted that this was not his job, he replied, "I'm an independent adult person and I make my own decisions," showing the very spirit that Charles and Emily had fostered, applied in exactly the wrong context. He was fired soon thereafter. His next job was at the White Plains Public Library. He developed his own idiosyncratic way of shelving videos, and unsurprisingly, the library staff wanted things done their way. Jason argued about it until they, too, had to let him go. He wants to open a store where he will tell people the inner messages of Disney movies, Emily explained. You wait in line, he says, next, and you come up and say, "Please, Jason, would you explain the inner meaning of The Hunchback of Notre Dame?" He would say, "The inner meaning is that it's what's inside people that counts, whether they're a good person, and that's more important than whether they're beautiful." "That'll be $50, please. Next." You cannot explain to him that people already know this, that they don't find it out at a store anyway. In some very, very basic ways, he's clueless. Emily threw up her hands. She told me mournfully, "The primary job of most parents is to make their kids think they can do anything. My primary job is to take him down." Reduced to a sentence, it's, "You're not smart enough to do what you want to do." Do you know how much I hate having to say that? When Jason was 20, his father was diagnosed with cancer, and 3 years later he died. Jason became deeply depressed. Emily became depressed too. Emily found Jason a therapist, then turned to Westchester ARC. The organization's name was originally an acronym for Association for Retarded Citizens, where Charles had served as president of the board. She wanted to qualify for ResHab, or residential habilitation, in which support staff come to a person's home and provide services and instruction in independent living skills. She was tossed around in the bureaucracy until she finally broke down in tears in front of a committee and said, "My kid is destroying himself. I can't do all of this myself." Jason was finally given a caseworker who came in 20 hours a week. "That was a great help," Emily said, "but I started realizing that it wasn't enough. I had to bite the bullet and acknowledge that as smart as he is, he needs more structure and supervision. He just is not eating healthy meals at a regular time each day, or getting himself up and to work on time." Emily decided that Jason needed to be in a group home. "It was a feeling of failure," she said. "We had worked so hard to make him the Down syndrome guy who didn't need it. But I had to look at what was best for him, and not at some ideal we had built up for ourselves." When Emily put Jason on the waiting list for a local facility, she found out that the wait was an impossible 8 years. "Raising a kid like Jason," she said, "the kid is the least of the challenges. Jason was there to put his arms around me when the bureaucracies had nearly killed me." Services are seldom available to anyone who does not have the wherewithal to battle agencies. Doing so often requires education, time, and money, which is a painful irony, given that these services are intended to benefit people who may be short on all three. One day, Emily spotted a house for sale in Hartsdale, New York, and realized it would be a perfect group home. It had 3 bedrooms, enough for Jason and a companionable 2 friends. It was near the main bus stop and across the street from a supermarket, a bank, and a pharmacy. Emily bought the house, then asked ARC to run it. The New York State Office of Mental Retardation and Developmental Disabilities now rents the house from Emily for the amount of her mortgage payment. Jason moved in with two of his best friends from the parties Emily had been throwing. The three receive Social Security disability checks that go straight to ARC, which spends the money to maintain and staff the house. They love one another, Emily said. They call themselves the Three Musketeers. Jason has a job working for the local radio station where he is happy. I'm stepping back a little, she said. The ultimate job is to appreciate him for who he is. And who he is really terrific. Anything he's accomplished because he really stuck to it. Nothing comes easy to him. She paused. He's kept a lot of dignity in the face of that. I really, really admire him tremendously. I'm also sad for him, because he's smart enough to know that almost everybody is accomplishing things that he's not. Smart enough to realize that his life is different. Even if a child never acquires the skills needed for independent living, he accumulates experience and history. He says to me that he wants this particular video, Emily said. And I used to say to him, you are intelligent enough to watch something better than that. I used to think that if I kept pushing, he would have a better life in the world. But now I think, well, if that's what he enjoys, who am I to interfere? So I don't buy things like the brave little toaster, but I don't give him a hard time if he wants to buy it for himself. You can have tulips and windmills coming out of your ears, but you don't ever get to the Uffizi, and that's it. A couple of years later, Jason was depressed again, and Emily reflected with concern on her original attempt to make Jason the highest-functioning DS kid in history. She said, with perfect hindsight, would I have done it differently? His intelligence has enriched our relationship so much, and I would never want to give that up. But I'll admit that lower-functioning Downs kids are happier, less obsessed with how unfair it is. They have an easier time in many ways. But is that better? He takes such pleasure in words, in using his mind. I went to a reading at Barnes & Noble that Jason and his friend did when their book was reissued. Jason answered the audience's questions with fluency and poise. Emily was aglow. And Jason was aglow, their pleasure in his intelligence a mutual delight. The parents of children with DS who had come to hear him were aglow too, with hope. During the book signing, people approached Jason reverently. He and Emily were heroes, and Jason loved being a hero. I could understand his loneliness, but I could not miss his pride. Once, when I was at Emily's house, she called Jason and offered to take him and his roommates to the Pirates of Penzance. After a pause, I heard her say wistfully, "Well, okay. I guess I'll go on my own." The cliché is that people with Down syndrome are incredibly sweet-natured, and they are, but they are unsubtle in their thinking, and Emily's nuanced disappointment had not registered with Jason, as it might with a typical child of 6 or 7. "He's not very introspective," she said. "He doesn't understand the origins even of his own feelings, so it's pretty much impossible for him to be outrospective and guess what's going on inside of me." A few years later, she said, "Actually, in some ways, he is the first kid with Down syndrome who is really introspective. It's not a boon to have Down syndrome and be introspective, because what you see when you look inside yourself are inadequacies. That's how deep he can look into himself. Jason was talking the other day about what he might have done if he hadn't had Down syndrome. I have never allowed myself that fantasy. It's too dangerous for me." For most of recorded history, DS has not been compared to a holiday among windmills and tulips. The idea that idiots were amenable to amelioration originated with Jean-Marc Gaspard Itard's attempt to educate the wild boy of Aveyron in the early 19th century. His theories were then developed by his pupil, Edouard Séguin, director of the Hospice des Incurables in Paris, who structured a system for assessing the intellectually disabled and was the first to recognize the merits of early treatment. If the idiot cannot be reached by the first lessons of infancy, he wrote, by what mysterious process will years open for him the golden doors of intelligence? Séguin emigrated to the United States in the middle of the 19th century and established institutions for the care and education of the disabled, whom he enabled to participate in civic life, often through manual labor. Yet even as Séguin was bringing about such transformation, others argued that the cognitively disabled were not merely stupid, but evil and corrupt. The language of accusing rectitude is reminiscent of the imaginationist argument that women who bore dwarfs did so because of their lascivious nature. Deformity and disability were interpreted as evidence of failure. Samuel G. Howe's 1848 report made to the legislature of Massachusetts articulates this pre-eugenic, dehumanizing vision. This class of persons is always a burden upon the public. Persons of this class are idle and often mischievous, and are dead weights upon the material prosperity of the state. They are even worse than useless. Each such person is like a upas tree that poisons the whole moral atmosphere around him. The first person to describe Down syndrome was John Langdon Down in 1866. He referred to his subjects as mongoloids, or mongoloid idiots, on the basis that their faces, with slightly slanted eyes, resembled those of people from Mongolia. Down proposed that human evolution had gone from black people to Asians to white people, and that white people born with mongolism were actually a throwback to their primitive Asian antecedents, a position then considered rather progressive insofar as it acknowledged evolution. By 1900, the jobs that had been done by Sagan's trained individuals with mental retardation were being claimed by the great influx of immigrants, who did them more efficiently, and the institutions originally intended to educate the intellectually disabled were used to exclude them from an efficiency-oriented industrial society. Medical texts delineated how to classify someone as an idiot, an imbecile, or a moron. Eugenicists provided a spurious validation of the link between mental retardation and criminality, and laws favoring sterilization were instituted. As late as 1924, a British scientist published material saying that these children actually were biological members of the Mongol race. That view was finally challenged in the 1930s by Lionel Penrose, a British doctor who used blood tests to prove that white people with DS were genetically related to other white people and not to Asians. Penrose also established that the greatest risk factor for DS was maternal age, identifying 35 as the cutoff point at which risk escalated. Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote in a 1927 Supreme Court decision, "It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime, or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. Three generations of imbeciles are enough." The forced sterilization law applied to people with many disabilities and disadvantages, but particularly focused on those with intellectual disabilities, was not repealed for almost 50 years. In 1958, a French geneticist, Jérôme Lejeune, presented to the International Congress of Genetics his evidence that the condition was the result of a triplication of the 21st chromosome, of which there should be only two copies. The scientific name for Down syndrome is trisomy 21. The psychoanalyst Erik Erikson, inventor of the term identity crisis, at the urging of his friend Margaret Mead, had sent his newborn son Neil to an institution within days of his birth in 1944, and kept his existence secret even from his other children, fearful that if anyone knew he had produced an idiot